all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And hello, America. This is Dale Thronberry, and I want to welcome you to Veterans Radio this beautiful Sunday in Michigan. It's about 20 degrees, and I think the snows are starting to fly, so I'm pretty excited about what the weather is going to be doing. But we're going to be talking today about Navy SEALs, and I'm really excited to talk to our two guests, Dick Couch, who is a writer and one of the authors of The Navy SEALs, Their Untold Story, regarding the PBS documentary that was on Veterans Day. I don't know if any of you got to see it. I watched it. It was really quite interesting. I didn't know that all these things about the Navy SEALs, and it's kind of cool, and I'm anxious to talk with Dick on the program. We had Bill Doyle on last week just a little bit to promote the program, and I hope you had the opportunity to watch it. And we're also going to have another Navy SEAL on later in the hour, and that's Bill Posey, a CW3, who's was in the Navy for, I don't know, 20-some-odd years, it sounds like, all the way from Vietnam up to Apollo 12, all the way back to Iraq and so forth. So I'm excited to have them both on the program. If you'd like to get in on the action today, you can give us a call here at Veterans Radio, locally in southeastern Michigan. It is 734-822-1600, 734-822-1600. If you're way out there, you can call us toll-free at 844-838-1600. That's 844-VET-1600. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and on Twitter. That's what Jim asked me to ask everybody to do. We're starting to pick up a lot more followers on both of those forms of social media. I was talking to Bob earlier today, and he went through a crash session on Facebook, so I guess you can find Bob Gould on Facebook now, which should be rather frightening, I would think, but to see what he has to say. I hope you all had a really good Veterans Day. It was a great thing around our area here in southeastern Michigan. Many, many colleges and schools were putting on presentations. It seemed like everywhere you went, there was a program thanking veterans for their service, and we're very grateful, as speaking for all veterans, that we are very grateful to all of you out there that decided to pay a little homage to the veterans in your local area. And it's been kind of exciting. World War II veterans were honored up in Lansing. They brought a whole bunch of them up there, and the governor talked with them. And it's nice to see. And we had a discussion about this at University of Michigan this week. There was a panel discussion talking about how veterans are being treated this generation. And I'm very proud to say that as a member of the Vietnam Veterans of America, they've gone out of their way as an association to make sure that these young men and women are not forgotten and not ignored. And it looks like it's paying off. So we're real pleased about that. So let's get right into our story right now. And joining me on the program here at Veterans Radio is Dick Couch. And Dick has been on Veterans Radio many, many times. He's a well-known author. There's no doubt about that. And a friend of ours, Dwight Zimmerman, has had Dick on a number of times talking about his program. So let's see. He's the author of 18 books on the military and military special operations, co-authored the 2012 New York Times bestseller of Tom Clancy's An Act of Valor, a graduate of the Naval Academy. He served as a division officer aboard a Navy destroyer and with the Navy Underwater Demolition and SEAL teams. He has also served as a CIA case officer and advisor to the Commander, U.S. Special Operations Command. Been an analyst on Fox, MSNBC, ABC. Been a guest on NPR, The O'Reilly Factor, Hardball, Chris Matthews, Brian Lamb, C-SPAN. I didn't see anything in here about Veterans Radio. But he lives in Ketchum, Idaho. So, Dick Couch, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you, Dale, and sorry for the admission there.
we're getting there. We're growing every day. And so we're excited to have you back on the program, Dick. And I wanted to ask you, how did you get involved in writing this particular book?
Well, it was an interesting process there. The people from PBS came to me and asked me if I would consult on the program, and I thought, well, this sounds very interesting, a two-hour special on the history of Navy SEALs. And then they had contracted with Bill Doyle to write the book, and I knew of Bill Doyle's work. He wrote a very fine book on Travis Patrickman and his involvement in the Battle of Ramadi. So I knew Owen, we talked it over, and so we became the authors of the book that's a companion to the PBS documentary. And it was kind of a fascinating undertaking. I've always written a little bit about the history of the SEAL teams in many of my books, but I've never really written a book on it. And got into it and delved into those stories. And so it was the teacher always learns more than the student. And in this case, the writer learned an awful lot. And hopefully was able to pass some of that on to the reader.
Well, we're talking with Dick Couch here on Veterans Radio, and we're talking about the PBS special, The Navy SEALs, The Untold Story, and the accompanying book that he and Bill Doyle wrote. And let's get a little history of the SEALs. When did they, you know, get started, or how did they get started?
Well, we trace our roots back to the Navy frogmen of World War II, and the Navy frogmen, like the SEALs, were born out of adversity. After the Battle of Tarawa, it became glaring that we needed to have information about hydrographic reconnaissance, and then we needed people to be able to go onto those landing beaches and deal with some of the obstacles. So it was a crash course in getting these people ready to go to Normandy and then certainly for our island hopping campaign across the Pacific. So it had to be done very quickly, and it had to be done, had to find some volunteers to do some things that are very difficult and very dangerous. The SEAL team's pretty much the same way. The late 50s, early 60s, there was a need for unconventional warfare, counterinsurgency type warfare, and so under the direction of John Kennedy, all services were to build up and enhance their capability in these areas. And so they took some of the veterans from the underwater demolition teams and retasked them with land duties, sea air land duties. And so the SEALs came to be just in time for Vietnam, and that's all they did for the next 10 years or so is combat operations in Vietnam. So I was born about a month before the Battle of Tarawa, so this has all taken place in my lifetime, even though I'm an old guy. It was a great thing to kind of see some of our history play out from the beginning up to the current time.
Well, I'm always fascinated. As you said, yes, sounds like we're both mid-century. Now, as they talk about furniture, that's the way they talk about us now. But how did you decide to go to the academy?
Well, it was one of those opportunities. I grew up in southern Indiana, and it's not like I was in Virginia or Pennsylvania or San Diego, where there's tremendous competition for these academy appointments. I was a pretty good high school runner, and that helped me a little bit there. And there was not very heavily competition within my district in Indiana, so I was able to slip in there with some of the some of my classmates who seemed to be a lot brighter and have a lot easier time of it, the academics there than I did. So I was very fortunate to go there, and I really appreciate, of all things I've done in my life, the opportunities that have come my way. No better opportunities ever presented itself than to attend the United States Naval Academy.
We've talked to a number of Naval Academy graduates recently, and they seem to have a very similar story. It sounds like it was a real learning experience. I wouldn't say it was a great time, like all the other academies. You know, the camaraderie and everything is probably the best part of the whole thing, not necessarily the discipline and all of the rules and regulations you have to follow, right?
Well, I think so, but it was and I'm sure that it's the same for those young men and women going to ROTC. It's exciting times. You think that you look back on them fondly, of course, but then not only was this a tremendous opportunity for somebody like me just off the turnip truck from Indiana, but almost all of our lives from the time we're 20 to 24, 25, that era in there, those are very, very meaningful times. And to be at a service academy at that time in my life, I was very fortunate.
From what I understand, it's a great experience, and I was fascinated when I was in high school just going down to the Naval Academy, and I think we went up to West Point and said, wow, this this looks really hard. And of course, at the time that we were looking at colleges, you know, both Army and Navy were big football schools. That's changed a little bit. Not much, though, from what I was saying over the weekend.
I think we spend a little, maybe it gets a little too much attention, but no, Army, Navy, and Air Force, football occupies certainly a significant place at those institutions.
I want to go back to the book just a little bit, Dick, and when you were talking about the early frogmen, and one of the stories that I read, and I'm hoping that you can straighten me out on this, is that their breathing apparatus, they were breathing in their own air somehow and recirculating it, and could you explain that to me, or am I way off base?
No, I think you're quite right. The initially, you know, in Normandy, the clearing of those beaches, and same thing during World War II, those were in on the surface, do your job, and get back out, and it didn't involve underwater. They started underwater types of things in the late 40s. Certainly there was a little bit of that went on during the Korean conflict. But basically, they're combat swimmers, not divers. The diving apparatus that was first designed by Dr. Lamberson with the OSS was a recirculating, was an oxygen recirculation device. And what that does is it meters in pure oxygen into your breathing mix, and then it passes your breath through a scrubber, barium hydroxide, that removes the carbon dioxide. So it gives you, it has depth restrictions when you're on pure oxygen, but it also has tremendous endurance. So some of these rigs you could be in the water for 6-7 hours, and there's no telltale bubbles, and they're much more efficient for military applications than are just the regular scuba where you're breathing air and when you exhale, it goes away.
Okay.
They're more sophisticated, but basically even the modern diving rigs currently used by the SEALs operate on the same principle as Dr. Lamberson's scuba.
I found that really fascinating to read that, and I really encourage people, if you get the opportunity, to go to PBS. I don't know if they're streaming the program yet or not, but you might want to check their schedule to see when it's on again. It's the Navy SEALs, Their Untold Story. It's a two-hour documentary, and it's really worthwhile. You were in Vietnam, am I not correct?
Yes, and to your point there, if you do go on the PBS site, you can. I think you can watch that just any time. Just pull it up on your laptop there and enjoy.
Okay. I have a question that was emailed to me about Vietnam, being in Vietnam, and the Navy Surface Warfare Officer Badge. Can you tell me what that is? Is that sort of like a combat infantry badge?
No, I think what it is within the Navy, Naval Service, we have warfare specialties, you know, surface warfare, aviation warfare, you have submariners and that type of thing. When I was just coming out of the Naval Academy in 1967 and 1968, the aviators had their wings that they wore proudly, and the submariners had their dolphins. But the folks aboard ship did not have a device, a surface warfare device.
Okay.
And the SEALs at the time did not have any special device. We wore our jump wings, but we didn't have SEAL special warfare device. That's changed now. All those surface warriors who are working on destroyers and cruisers and that type of thing, they're surface warfare specialists, and they have a little gold device they proudly wear. And of course, within the SEAL teams now, we have our special warfare device. It's called a Trident.
Right.
And so that's what that's about.
Okay. So this started off, I'm guessing, as a surface warfare officer, and then the enlisted warfare badge came along shortly thereafter.
Well, they both, there was surface warfare badge for an officer enlisted. I think that came, I could be wrong on that, I think that came into being in the early or mid 70s, about the same time the special warfare device came on.
Okay.
It used to be something different for officers enlisted, but certainly within the SEAL teams, they're both the same.
Okay. Hopefully, George, to our listener, George, who sent in that question that answers it for you. We're going to take a quick break right now. Dick, if you would hold on, please. I want you to hang on, and I want to bring Bill Posey on in just a moment. So we're going to talk at Naval SEALs. If you want to get involved in the conversation out there, all you SEAL admirers, give us a call here on Veterans Radio at 734-822-1600 or toll-free 844-838-1600. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back.
Living at American House is like being on a cruise ship with all the lovely surroundings, the many, many activities, and the people to share with. It's so comfortable to be here. I feel safe. I don't have to shop. I don't have to cook. I don't have to clean up.
When you move into an American House senior living community, you open the door to a new world of possibilities. Our life enrichment directors are committed to enhancing the lives of residents every day. We look forward to finding out what interests you.
I just get dressed up and walk down to the dining room and enjoy my meals in the company of other people at my table.
For more moments made in American House, go to AmericanHouse.com. Again, that's AmericanHouse.com. Or watch us at YouTube.com/AmericanHouseLiving.
Living here has enriched my life. I'm Carol Huck, and I made in American House.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we are talking today about Navy SEALs. And so we're hoping that you want to get in on the conversation. We'll give us a call here at WHAM at 734-822-1600 and ask us a question if you wanted to know anything about the SEALs. We've got two longtime Navy SEALs on the program. We've got Dick Couch, whose newest book is Navy SEALs, Their Untold Story. And joining me on the line right now is CW3, retired Bill Posey. Bill, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Dale.
All right. I asked Dick the same question. How did you get into the Navy and into the SEALs?
Captain Couch was very smart in what he did, but I went the other way. I took the enlisted way, and I was on aboard a submarine. And at that time, it was a World War II type of submarine, and I hated it because I was an engineman, and we were constantly greasy. And we would go to bed on our off time, and we'd be so greasy our head would slide off the pillow. So one day I went to the Cobb, the chief of the boat, and I said, you know, I'm not a quitter, but I just can't take this submarine. I'll go into the Army. And we joined the Navy to stay out of the Army. And he said, Posey, do I have a deal for you? They're recruiting SEALs today, and if you go down and pass the test, you can be a SEAL team guy. And at that time, nobody knew what a SEAL team guy was. And I said, well, what is it? And he says, you lay on the beach, you at least have two girlfriends and all the beer you can drink, and the Navy will pay you to do that. I said, man, that is my gig. Let me go for that.
Boy, I wish they'd come and talk to me. I didn't know anything about that one.
So I just fell into it.
So you you were, when were you in Vietnam, Bill?
I was in Vietnam in late 68, 69.
And you were part of the Brown Water Navy, I'm assuming, as they call it?
I was. I was the UDT guy.
Okay. And
underwater demolition team.
Did you go all over the country, or were you in a specific area, or how did that work?
No, we were on board. There was two or three different things that you could do, two or three different missions. And I was on board a destroyer escort, and we would go along the beaches of Vietnam getting ready for the big invasion, amphibious invasion that never happened. So we would do hydrographic reconnaissance. And then I was lucky enough to go down to Seafloat in the Mekong Delta and operate out of Seafloat on swift boats.
Okay. And Dick, what was your job in Vietnam?
Well, I spent a couple, I was, not unlike Bill, I toured aboard a destroyer, and I was a gunnery officer and first lieutenant aboard a combatant there. But when I went back there with SEAL Team 1, I was a platoon commander, and this was in 70, 71, and I operated in the lower delta. We were primary tasked with going out and conducting unconventional warfare, which meant we were looking for senior Viet Cong leaders and conducting, going out at night and trying to interdict them and find them and engage them and fight the battle.
I know we're not allowed to tell any of the things that we did when we were in Vietnam, it seems, because 30, 40, 50 years later, part of my mission was to drop off Army long-range patrols, and they would go out, and it sounds like they did similar things, just kind of cause trouble, and if they could find somebody, either bring them back to interrogate them or make them disappear, whatever the scenario might be. Bill, I can't remember. I was talking to a good friend of yours, John Malloy, who happens to be an Army Ranger. I don't know if John's listening to the program or not, but he did mention that, some of your activities in Vietnam, were you doing the same types of thing as Dick was?
No, we had a different mission than Captain Couch. We were mainly trying to interdict people in coming down to Mekong or people who operated inside of the Delta there. And so we had a bit of a mission doing a lot of different things. Wherever they needed us, that's where they would send us. We would also support SEAL Team 1 at that time.
Okay.
Different operations.
Different operations. I'm sorry. I thought I read this in something when I was preparing for the program that one of you were involved in attempting to rescue POWs. Was that either one of you?
Captain Couch.
That would probably be me. That was one of the missions that came to us as operating SEAL platoons, and then we get, there was probably never more than six platoons operating in Vietnam, and never more than maybe 100, 120 SEALs in country at any one time. But one of the missions that we were tasked with was personnel recovery when we'd find POW missions, and very much like today. You have to be very careful. You're trying to get in there and use the element of surprise to get to the captives before the enemy can get to them and either move them or hurt them. So we looked for those opportunities when they came to us, but that was just one of the missions that the SEALs were tasked with in that particular war.
Okay, because I was wondering, because when I was reading the article, it had mentioned something that right around the time of the Song Tay raid, there was another raid going on that was successful, but it wasn't that we'd never heard about. So maybe it was, maybe I'm just making the whole thing up. I don't know.
I conducted a raid, I think it was in November sometime, and it was almost within days of the Song Tay raid. And we got no Americans out, but we did get 19 Vietnamese soldiers that were being held in a POW camp and managed to get in there and chase off the guard force and get them all out. And so made us all feel pretty good to do something like that.
I would think so. Dick, how long did you spend in the Navy?
I was on the, probably I'm not unlike Bill. I spent 5 years on active duty, and then I finished off the next 25 years as a reservist. So I was basically around it, but only on active duty for 5 years, and certainly not in combat after that.
Well, Bill, we're coming up on the bottom of the hour, but I understand that you were involved in the space program as part of your career.
I was, yes, sir.
Can you tell us a little bit about that experience with Apollo 12?
Nobody wanted to do it. They always asked for volunteers. On this mission for 4.5 hours, and for the first hour and a half, you were on scuba, and so you would constantly be seasick because you're on the surface with breathing scuba. And so you'd take the mouthpiece out, throw up, and then put the mouthpiece back in.
Ooh.
So it was miserable for that first hour and a half, and after that it was okay. We had a repertoire of times that we had to hit constantly. And if we didn't hit those times, NASA would be very unhappy. But it all worked out. On my particular Apollo 12, we had some of the roughest seas they ever had. And we were very lucky to break the record at that time of getting these guys out of the capsule. And by the time they got out of the capsule, I mean, they were as green as grass because they were so seasick from being inside of the capsule. I really felt sorry for the astronauts. It was a lot of fun after it got over.
I would think so. Of course, these aren't the stories that we hear that the astronauts would actually be getting seasick. I can't imagine being in those little capsules rocking back and forth on the ocean like that. After that, Bill, what were your tasks? Did you go into the reserves or did you stay active duty?
Yeah, after Apollo, I was going to go on Apollo 13, and I did part of it, but then I got out, and then I stayed in the reserves, and then I got out of the reserves for a couple of years, and then came back in the reserves, and then was lucky enough to go to, after 2001, got to go to the back to Iraq, or to Iraq.
Okay.
So it was interesting, the transition between the Dick Couch Vietnam guys and the new folks that went to Iraq. A completely different breed of folks.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about that. We have to take a break for the news in about a minute, I'm guessing. One or two. And fingers being thrown back at me back and forth over there. But, I guess with that time, Bill, what was the main difference between when you were beginning, in the Vietnam era, and when you went back to Iraq at a much older age?
In the Vietnam era, everybody was much more humorous, and you got to do a lot of things because we were the only people out in the field. Everybody else, a lot of the army, wanted to stay behind the wire, so we could do a lot of things that we could not normally do.
Go ahead. I was going to say, so you had a little bit more freedom in Vietnam than you do now?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was really a lot of fun. And Iraq was much more stilted, and everybody's kind of worried now about their career, and rightfully so. Then, in the 60s, we could have cared less about anything.
That's true. Well, on that note, Dick, I'm hoping you'll stay on. We're going to come back after the news and talk about more SEALs. We have a caller on the line who wants to talk about SEALs. So we'll be right back after these messages and the news. Stay tuned. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
This is the Blaze Radio News. I'm Mike Craig. The White House is confirming the beheading victim shown in a video posted by ISIS is American hostage Peter Kasich. The video posted this morning shows a decapitated head at the feet of a masked man. More now from the Blaze Radio's Tom Peace.
The new video, running nearly 16 minutes long, also shows what appears to be the mass beheading of more than a dozen captured Syrian soldiers. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his country supports the U.S. in its fight against ISIS.
We see these horrors, this additional atrocity, and the people of Israel are with you. We're with the family. We're with all the American people who understand the savagery that we're all up against.
He says this is a global fight.
I think we have a global conflict here. I mean, basically, the Middle East is awash with militant Islamists.
Netanyahu on CBS's Face the Nation.
With President Obama on the verge of signing executive actions for immigration reform, one top-ranking Republican says that will not lead to a government shutdown in Washington.
The president wants a fight. I think he's actually trying to bait us into doing some of these extreme things that have been suggested. I don't think we will.
Congressman Tom Cole on ABC's This Week says he thinks the president should have passed his own immigration reform bill when Democrats controlled Congress. A surgeon infected with Ebola is in critical condition at a Nebraska hospital. Doctors treating Dr. Martin Saleh of Sierra Leone describe his treatment as an hour-by-hour situation. Saleh is the third Ebola patient to undergo treatment at the hospital's biocontainment unit. Saleh is a permanent resident of the United States. A cruise ship is back in a Southern California port after more than 170 people on board became sick. A spokeswoman for Carnival says the sick passengers and crew members on the Crown Princess are suffering from a gastrointestinal ailment caused by norovirus. This is news on the Blaze Radio Network. Truth lives.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. PFC Alfred Wilson threw himself on a grenade knowing full well the result of his actions. Details after this.
This is boot camp. This is the real thing now. You've never done anything so hard in your life. You don't understand how you can finish. It takes inner strength and desire to become a Marine. When I finished, I was like, I did it. The moment I will never forget is when this drill instructor that I admire so much comes up to me and said, "Good morning, Marine."
PFC Summer Volkman became a United States Marine. and you? Call 1-800-MARINES.
While returning from a reconnaissance in-force mission in the vicinity of Fire Support Base Cunningham in Quang Tri Province, the 1st Platoon of Company M came under intense automatic weapons fire and a grenade attack from a well-concealed enemy force. As the center of the column was pinned down, the leading squad moved to outflank the enemy. Wilson, acting as squad leader of the rear squad, skillfully maneuvered his men to form a base of fire and act as a blocking force. In the ensuing firefight, both his machine gunner and assistant machine gunner were seriously wounded and unable to operate their weapons. Realizing the urgent need to bring the weapon into operation again, Wilson, followed by another Marine and with complete disregard for his safety, fearlessly dashed across the fire-swept terrain to recover the weapon. As they reached the machine gun, an enemy soldier stepped from behind a tree and threw a grenade toward the two Marines. Observing the grenade fall between himself and the other Marine, fully realizing the inevitable result of his actions, shouted to his companion and unhesitatingly threw himself on the grenade, absorbing the full force of the explosion with his own body and ultimately dying.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we're talking Navy SEALs, and I don't know if there's a Navy SEAL song or not. I couldn't find one. So anyway, joining us on the lines right now are all guys are both retired, I'm assuming. Dick Couch, who's the author of the newest book on the Navy SEALs, Their Untold Story. He and Bill Doyle wrote this to go along as a companion piece for the two-hour PBS documentary that aired last Tuesday, and if you go to PBS, you can probably find it online and can watch it at your leisure. It's a great program to look at. Our other guest is Warrant Officer Bill Posey, and I love Warrant Officers. I don't know if I like W-3s, but I like Warrant Officers anyway, but who was in Vietnam and also ended up going back to Iraq. And if you want to get in on the conversation, you can call us here at Veterans Radio at 734-822-1600. Or toll-free 844-838-1600. And we do have a caller on the line, and a gentleman, I'd like to bring him on. I've got BJ from Arizona. BJ, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, hi. This is a her.
Her, okay.
And,
they didn't say
that. I wondered
that.
if you gentlemen have ever heard of the Beach Jumpers in your history going back there.
Gentlemen, either one of you heard of the Beast Jumpers?
I think what she means is Beach Jumpers, and the Beach Jumpers were an organization that were part of special operations back during the Vietnam era, and they were undertaken with beach management, marshalling of amphibious troops coming ashore, and some of those issues. They were part of the amphibious Navy, as were the UDTs, and they helped with amphibious landing.
Does that answer your question? I hope.
SEALs?
Pardon?
Would they have been considered SEALs in today's terms, or?
Oh.
Well, here's my story. I'm 62 years old. My dad's been dead for 38 years, and he was in the Navy, and he had two daughters, and we never ever heard him once tell a war story. I knew he was in the Navy, and there was a big sword in our hallway closet that he said he took off a German soldier. But my aunt, who was his sister, has just recently started sending me things, and it was this Beach Jumpers thing, and their emblem looked like the same, real similar to today's SEALs emblem. And so I actually just got off the phone with her a little while ago as I started digging for more. And it's like this has just been revealed to me that, you know, that's what he had done. And there was a nice letter she sent me of the Navy thanking him after his service. He was in 4 years. And it's sure isn't like that today. I read that letter and I went, I want that America back. But,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful letter. And just, you know, wishing him well in his life, and, you know, they wanted to thank him and all this kind of stuff. So, but I just wondered, because my aunt seemed to think that, you know, he was one of the original Navy SEALs before they were SEALs. So that's why I wanted to clarify it a little bit more for my own info. Thank you.
Thank you, CJ. All right. It sounds like maybe that he might have had that badge that we talked about earlier on.
Well, I tell you, the beach jumpers were their own unit. They were very important. They were sailors, but they weren't Navy SEALs. Mm-hmm. If you go online, there's a U.S. Navy Beach Jumper Association. They've got all their patches up there. They've got stories about what they did and how they did it and what they did in Vietnam and places like that. So I would recommend that the caller just go online, learn more about it, and she'll learn more about how her father served in the United States Navy.
I'm still wondering how he got the sword from the Germans.
That's very interesting, but who knows?
You never know, right?
One clarification that I might make that maybe Captain Couch wasn't familiar with, because he was a SEAL team guy. I was a UDT guy. And when they gave us our trident, actually not a trident, it was a UDT badge, and the officers had gold, where in UDTs, the enlisted had silver. And it was a little, we didn't have the ego, we had the musket and all that. So that's where the differentiation at the beginning when they passed out those devices came.
Okay.
Well, I was actually had a silver device on my chest.
Mm-hmm. And when did you become, Bill, I'm talking to Bill Posey here, when did you become a warrant officer and how did that come about?
I became a warrant officer. I couldn't make Master Chief. And I wanted to make, I mean, I think every enlisted guy in the world wants to make Master Chief an E-9. And I had great evals, but at that time we didn't have a SEAL rate. So I was a CB, I was an equipment operator CB, senior chief. And I went to the board guys after they had a board, and I said, I have great evals. Why didn't you promote me? And they said, Posey, we wouldn't promote you if you were the last guy there, because you'll never do us any good as a Master Chief because you've always been a SEAL. So then I applied to be a warrant officer, which turned out to be a great thing for me. I love warrant officers.
I'm sure a warrant officer today is a lot different than the warrant officer when I was one, because we considered ourselves the closest thing to a civilian that the military had. Because we didn't have any real command responsibility. Our only job was whatever it happened to be. Mine, you know, was flying helicopters. So,
yes, sir.
I like
good thing though about a warrant officer. You could be, you're neither fish nor fowl. So the beauty of it is, if you want to act like an enlisted guy, you can, and if you want to act like, at least for the Navy, an officer. So it gave me great latitude in Iraq to help supply my guys with a lot of stuff that I would have not normally been able to get. So it really worked out well for me when the Iraqi war started, because we went forward with nothing, and I was able to negotiate for supplies and everything because of my rank.
I did want to go into that a little bit. After 9/11, you went active duty again. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes, sir.
And then how did you end up in Iraq? Because how old were you then? Were what, 40-something?
I was 55 years old.
That's what I was going to say. I don't think you're running laps anymore at 55.
Well, actually, I still could pass a SEAL, you know, the PRT, so I'm fortunate there.
One of those, okay.
I've never been as athletic as Captain Couch. He was always a great athlete, but I could still pass. And they needed people to go forward, and when they activated, I was a reservist at the time. They asked for volunteers to go forward, and I was the first to raise my hand because I really like going in that situation. And they said, Posey, you'll be the last person that we're sending. He says, you're too fat, you're too old, and you're too stupid, and you're not going forward. And I said, okay, we'll find out. But I was, I have an expertise in vehicles, and constantly our vehicles would constantly break down even before the war. So I was lucky enough that they sent me forward, and then I was able to get into the fight after that. It was a real good deal for me.
Well, it sounds like you were the scrounger, the guy who found everything that they needed. Because in reading your little story I read about in the Orange County newspaper, there wasn't anything there when you first guys got there.
Yeah, we were lucky enough to, when we hit the Saddam Hussein airport, the Iraqis threw all their arms and all their flags and all their paraphernalia down. So we could trade that for different things that we needed because we had no funding at that time to supply us with anything. So because I had been in Vietnam, I knew what was going to happen, and so I was lucky enough to acquire a lot of things to support our troops until we had our logistics tail come 6 months later.
Okay. Dick, when you got out of the active duty, what made you start writing these stories? How did that come about?
Well, it's I left active service and I joined the Central Intelligence Agency, where I did things that were not terribly dissimilar to what I was doing in the Navy, and I'm very proud to have been with that organization as I was with the Navy. But as far as writing books goes, you reach a certain age where you can no longer maybe do these things or you're no longer being tasked with doing those things. And I thought, well, maybe I can write about them. And I thought about writing spy stories since I had a background in that. But then that was back when there were no books written about Navy SEALs, and so I wrote SEAL Team One, and it turned out to be to sell an awful lot of books. And as a matter of fact, still in print. So I was very lucky to step into the first of the Navy SEAL books, and to one thing led to another, and I was able to found out that my calling was writing stories and telling stories, and so I was very fortunate to move on from there.
Well, I know I've read many of your books, and they are great stories, and I encourage our audience to go out and find the stories by Dick Couch. You have your own website, don't you, Dick?
Yes, www.dickcouch.com. My books are all on there, and they can be ordered just about anywhere, but all of the books that I have written are featured on that website.
Right, and I know that they can go to Amazon and probably find most of them there, too.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, we certainly appreciate the effort that you've gone through in writing these stories. Otherwise, we wouldn't know about these amazing men, because they don't talk about themselves outside of their small little group.
At least they didn't used to.
Well, could you guys hold on for a second? I got to take another break. When we come back, let's talk a little bit about that story. All righty? So, yeah, you're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back about the true story of Navy SEALs and how they feel about people talking in the public eye, so to speak. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we're talking to two Navy SEALs, Dick Couch, who's as an author, and Bill Posey, who is just likes to be in a SEAL, I think. You just recently retired. Isn't that true, Bill?
Oh, it's been quite a while. It's been 10 years now.
10 years. Wow, that picture makes you look. I should know more. I should get the date on the pictures there. Okay, so we've had this Navy SEAL come forward and say that he was the one who shot bin Laden. Dick, I'll start with you first. What was your reaction to that?
Well, I think that some of these tell-all books are inappropriate. The bin Laden operation was very much a team-centric operation, and it was far-reaching. It included the intelligence gatherers, the analysts, combat support, aviation support. There were a lot of moving parts that put that team at that compound with that target inside. And then there were the members of that team there as well. So I think for one person to step forward and said, I did it, I'm the guy who pulled the trigger, I think it cheapens the fine work that was done start to finish to make that operation happen. So I was not, I'm kind of, I hate to be the guy in the glass house throwing rocks, but I think that both
Mark Olin and Rob O'Neill. I think that they have no business speaking about these things. I think it's disingenuous, and it cheapens the service of those who are still on active duty, still looking for those good missions in the service of our country, while they're using that position. Legally, they might be on shaky ground. Morally, I think they're definitely on shaky ground as far as the CLFOS goes. And I'd sure appreciate hearing what Bill has to say about that.
Bill, what do you think?
You know, I'm a study of history, and the historian to Alexander the Great was Calnithesis, and he wrote great volumes on what Alexander the Great, and then other people picked it up, because there's nothing left of his work. Other people picked that up and were able to write their own volumes. And if he wouldn't have done that, we wouldn't have a clue, or we would have had a much broader perspective of what Alexander the Great did. I'm actually happy to see those guys do it so that they get the mystery out of it. And I think most secrets after 10 years or 5 years are pretty much out of the bag anyhow. The problem with it is, he's putting the thumb on himself with some type of retribution. Hopefully not, but you know that would be my only worry for him and his relatives there, that somebody might come and try to take it out on him.
That's what I thought. I mean, I watched him do an interview, and he was very. I mean, he was sharing responsibility with the other team members. It seemed as people. It's sort of like he started at the back of the line, and as people were, falling to the wayside or going into a different room, he kept moving up, and he ended up, in the top room of that building. But, I don't know. I kind of – my own personal opinion is I don't know if he should have come right out and said that he was the one that fired the shots. But as you point out, Bill, it does put his family at risk, I think. And also it takes away from the whole idea of the team aspect of everything that has to do with, you've got the SEALs, you've got the aviation units that are attached, you've got the intelligence units that are attached, and so on and so forth. And you got to wonder what might be said that might put some of those other men and/or women, at risk.
Absolutely right.
So I guess we're not going to solve that problem today. Bill, I wanted to know. You have a camp named after, well, not named after you, but after your daughter, isn't it, over in Iraq? Can you tell us a little bit about how that happened? And don't be shy. It's okay.
What happened is when we went to the Saddam Hussein International Airport, we were some of the first ones there, and we saw the palace on the hill, the Rawalpindi Palace, and we said, man, this is a score. We're SEAL team guys are going to be up in the palace. So we go up in the palace, and it's perfect. The beds are made. I mean, it's just beautiful. The pool is full of water. I mean, they just left. And so we said, well, we're going to stay here. And then our commanding officer said, no, we shouldn't stay here, because as soon as the Army arrives, they're the 800-pound gorilla here in Iraq, because we're 471 miles away from the ocean. And so we went down to where the caretakers were, and they had stripped out that whole camp there, but we had 11-foot wall all the way around it, so it was a perfect place for us to be. And so they called it Camp Trident, and then they kept changing the name, and nobody really knew where we were at. So I went to a meeting one day, and this Army fellow that was attached to SEAL Team, John Malloy, he was a E-8 Army fellow, he said, we're going to name this camp today, and everybody takes John with a grain of salt. In our morning meeting, they said, we're going to name this camp Bill Posey. Oh, my gosh, it was terrible, because only real good SEAL team guys or people who've died have a camp named after him, not some schlub like myself. And I said, oh, man. So I thought about what was going on, because the Army had just come into our area and taken over control of our, they were the main headquarters now. And they said, stop, we're not going to do any more operations until we get a handle on what's going on. So I went to that morning meeting with the Army folks, and I said, hey, we're going to name our SEAL team camp after an Army person, because we want to honor the Army, and we want to get back our op tempo. And everybody said, you know, are you crazy? What's going on? So then I went back, and my daughter was a student at UCLA in the ROTC program, and she was in the Army. Her name was Jenny Posey. So we named the camp Camp Jenny Posey. And so it was kind of a funny thing. But 2 days later, we were back on our op tempo, and it worked perfectly. So I was really proud of that.
You were, even though you were 55 years old plus, you were involved in quite a few missions, weren't you?
I was, but I was a C2 guy. I was never front.
Happy.
SEAL team is like a ballet with bullets, and you have to really be in tune with what's going on. And because I was so old, I would just be a C2 guy out in the heatherland waiting for people to squirt out of whatever, you know, wherever they were. So that I was involved in quite a few, but not a frontline guy like the real shooters, you know.
Okay. Dick, I just wanted to ask you if you could describe what it was like for you to be a Navy SEAL and what it's like to be one today. And, you know, you can say, what did you do, Daddy, in the war? You say, I was a SEAL. How does that make you feel?
I don't know that I've really even given it that much thought. I've always felt that being a Navy SEAL, I'm proud and privileged to have done that type of thing. But I felt it's just a warfare specialty. I think that a guy who's a Navy SEAL can take no more pride in his work than a Ranger with the 75th Ranger Regiment or a Special Forces soldier or a Marine Special Operator or any other service member of that, for that matter. I think that we're privileged to serve, and certainly you get a lot of accolades for the type of thing we do. But I think that any service member should take pride in the execution of service to their country, and good on them for doing so. As far as being a Navy SEAL, it was my way of serving. I'm proud to have done it, but I think there's the pride certainly is, and the rewards are certainly no greater than serving in any other branch of the military.
Do you think the Navy SEALs are getting too much publicity?
Well, it would seem that they do get an awful lot of publicity. We don't hear much from the Marine Special Operators, the Green Berets, and the Ranger Regiment, and I know they serve tirelessly. I've spent time with all of them. I never met a platoon sergeant with the 75th Ranger Regiment with less than 13 combat rotations. Never met one. So there's a lot of special operators working very hard and doing some great things over there, and they're not all just Navy SEALs. I'm parochial enough to be proud of my organization, but let's not forget all those other people that we never hear about, but they're over doing great work and in the service of their country.
Right, and I agree, because I just ran into somebody the other day who was an Air Force Special Forces guy, and I'd never even heard of the Air Force having anything like that.
And special tactics teams.
Yeah, that's what they are. Special tactics team. Bill, I know you're very proud of being a Navy SEAL, of course, and all the other things that you've accomplished with your life. I'm going to embarrass John Malloy a little bit. Could you just tell me, how did this Ranger get so entwined with the Navy SEALs?
He was asked to come by the SEAL team because they wanted a person who didn't have an axe to grind when they graded the pre-workups for SEAL team.
Oh,
so that's
okay.
What Ranger Malloy did. He was a grading person and said he went directly to the admiral and he said these guys are fit for to go forward. So he was there for 4 years, then he came back and did another 4 years, so he was completely in. He knew everybody and he worked with everybody and had great expertise in land warfare, and Ranger things. So everybody really did well by listening to him on what the Rangers did and how they did it. So we were able to capture that knowledge from him. And then when we went forward, he spoke Army. So we could go, Ranger and I went every night before a mission and cleared the area of operation with the Army. And they would pay heed to him, where other people, if we went there with Navy guys, they might not be as courteous. And Ranger really worked out well for us. He's a fabulous guy. I just got one quick story with your permission.
Okay, I got about
2 minutes.
He would
go down in Baghdad and right through Saddam Hussein Airport, and people would call out his name. And I said, Ranger, how do they know you? He said, well, I've been in 5 wars, and everybody seems to know me in the Ranger community. So he's a remarkable guy.
He is. I had an opportunity. That's how I met you. I was talking to John a couple of weeks ago, and he says, I needed to call Bill Posey to find out about the Rangers. And then when I saw the picture and he was at your retirement dinner, I couldn't figure out what this Army guy doing with all those white uniforms and so forth there. So it was kind of interesting. Well, gentlemen, I'm going to have to wrap this up. I've only got about a minute to go. And I want to thank you both for being on Veterans Radio, and I'd love to have you both back on the program at some time in the future and tell a couple of war stories here and there, okay?
Thank you, Dale. Thank you, Dale.
Thank you, Dick. Thank you, Bill Posey. Thank you very much. We're going to be back next week with going to be talking about the Battle of the Bulge, and Bob Gould will be your host, and he's got John McManus and Kevin Heimel with him next week to talk about the Battle of the Bulge. And we've got other things coming up. If you have any stories that you want us to tell, please contact us here at Veterans Radio, and we'll try to get them on the air. You can go to our Facebook page. You can go to our Twitter account, whatever you want. Just send them along to us, and we'll try to follow up on them. Until next week, it's been a pleasure talking to you. You are dismissed.